Well, we tried to do a very ambitious thing last time, and that was cover 4 centuries in one evening. Suffice it to say, we didn't make it. We got 3 centuries down, and that means we're going to try to do 3 tonight. The 3 centuries that we're going to try to do are the 900s, the 1000s, and the 1100s. The handout for this evening, the one that says 1100s at the top, covers the 1100s and the 1000s. Covers the 1000s and the 1100s. We are, however, going to do the 900s, and that was the handout from last week. I think there's some still on the table there. Would anybody like one? Can I bring you one? Anybody need one? I think it says starts with the 600s. Everyone has that? Okay, great. Good. Well, flip back in the past the 600, 700, 800s to the 900s, and we'll begin there. Well, things went from bad to worse in the 900s. We already know that we're in the Dark Ages, which is roughly 500 to 1,000. The Dark Ages were begun by the German tribes who came down and basically destroyed the Roman Empire. But now in the 900s, the Germans have been assimilated, but we're getting new groups showing up who are devastating the landscape. This includes the Normans, which is an abbreviation for Northmen. It means Vikings, basically. They came down from Scandinavian countries along the Atlantic coast of Europe, came into the Mediterranean, trashed Sicily, trashed southern Italy, eventually wound up settling in that section of France that we now call Normandy. Another group that was attacking in the 900s is the Muslims. Muslims from Asia Minor, or present-day Turkey, or that Near Eastern region were referred to as Saracens, as opposed to Muslims further west in Africa, who were known as Moors from Morocco. So the Muslims are attacking. The Hungarians are attacking. These are not the Huns, they were back in the 400s, but other Central Asian grasslands. Tribes are attacking the Magyars and the Avars, who eventually settle in the Hungarian plain. So there's a great deal of upheaval, and there's no law and order at all. In other words, it's a complete breakdown of law and order, such as we're seeing in Baghdad, for example, or the Anbar province. It's during this period that the papacy sinks to one of the two lowest points that it has ever sunk to. One of the two lowest points that it has ever sunk to is during the Renaissance, at the time of the Protestant Reformation, which we'll be getting to in a couple of sessions from now. But here in the 900s is one of the worst periods. It was so bad that this period of the papacy is referred to as the pornocracy. Porneia is the Greek word which means sexual immorality. Krasi means to rule, like democracy or monarchy. So it wasn't really ruled by prostitutes, but it's called that because it was ruled by very influential women in Rome, and there was a lot of sexual immorality going on. All of the popes from 904 to 964 are puppets of one family of nobles in Rome. They're named after Theophylact, who was the leader of the family at the turn of the century around 900. Theophylact caused his protege, Sergius III, to become pope in 904. We're told that Sergius took Theophylact's daughter, 15-year-old daughter Marozia, as a lover, and the two of them produced an offspring named John. He will eventually be pope. When Theophylact dies, his widow, Theodora, marries again, and she promotes her own candidates for the papacy. She causes Anastasius III to become pope. She causes Lando to become pope, Pope Lando, 913 and 914. She causes John the X become pope. Then the daughter takes over, Marozia. She marries and basically rules Rome from the papal palace. Any pope at this time is going to be a puppet of hers. Her first husband dies, she marries again. The second husband imprisons the pope, John X, who had been her father's protege. And John X disappears in prison, probably murdered, we don't know. She has a son who's too young to be pope. You have to be 20 to be pope at this time. So she installs a couple of elderly popes who are going to last a couple of years each. And she's right, each of them lasts a couple of years. This is 929 to 931 and 931 itself. Stephen VIII and John XI. But these are just fill-in popes until her son is old enough. And as soon as he's old enough, she causes the election of her son, John, who becomes John XI. Well, it's time for mom to get her comeuppance. So her son, Alberic, replaces her. She goes off into prison and dies 12 years or so later. We don't know when she died. Alberic II is now on the throne. He's completely in charge of the papacy, and anybody that he nominates is going to become pope. So he's a strong man, but he also seems to have been somewhat reform-minded, because most of the popes that he promoted in the second quarter of the 900s tended to be reform-minded. And they're listed there on the middle of the second. Oh, my pages don't match yours. Sorry, I reprinted this. Then there comes to the papal throne probably the worst pope ever. This is John XII. He was in charge from 955 to 964. He is the king's 18-year-old son. Shouldn't have become pope in the first place at that age. There's a description of him, which I quote from the church historian Duquesne. Ever heard of Duquesne University in Pittsburgh? I got a daughter going there right now. That's named after Duquesne. His nights, no less than his days, were spent in the company of women and young men, in hunting and banqueting. His sacrilegious love affairs were flaunted unashamedly. Here no barrier restrained him, neither the rank of the women for whom he lusted, nor even his kinship with them. The Lateran was a bad house. No decent woman was safe in Rome. This debauchery was paid for from the church's treasury, a treasury filled by a simony. Simony is purchase of religious things, especially papal office and other offices, which was utterly regardless of the character of those who paid. We hear of a boy of 10 consecrated bishop, of a deacon ordained in the stable, of high dignitaries deprived of their eyes or castrated. Cruelty crowned the debauchery. That nothing might finally be lacking, impiety too was given its place. And men told how, in feasting at the Lateran, the pope used to drink to the health of the devil. Well, fortunately, that's the one and only instance of that bad of a pope that we've had. It's amazing when you think about it that hasn't happened, that it hasn't happened that we've had popes that bad more often. Remember Jesus' promise in Matthew 16:18 or so? On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. The gates of hell have come close, but they have never prevailed against the church, and never will. But this certainly shows us how bad it can get. Religious orders are in terrible shape in the 900s because there's no law and order anywhere. Monks freely leave their monasteries and wander and become totally worldly. The invasions of the Normans, the Muslims, and the Hungarian tribes destroy a lot of monasteries. In France, some of the monasteries only allow children of noblemen into them, and so these noble males wind up marrying, having their children, their hunting dogs, and so on in the monastery. One effort to reform the monasteries was the initiation of something called exemptions. An exemption means that a monastery is exempt from having to answer to a local bishop. Instead, the monastery will be directly answerable to the Pope. Some of the popes in the 900s, some of the better ones, used exemptions as a way of bypassing corrupt local bishops in order to try and raise the standards of the monasteries. Also, in 909, a new monastery was founded, still a Benedictine monastery, called Cluny. No relation to the actor. Cluny is a very reform-minded monastery, and it had the great good fortune of having three or four abbots in a row who were very long-lived. Each of them was in charge for 50, 60 years, and each of them was very strict and demanded discipline, demanded proper recitation of the Liturgy of the Hours, proper saying of Masses, and so on. So Cluny became the center of gravity for a reform movement. Other abbots of like mind affiliated themselves with Cluny, and so it became kind of a mother house. It also founded a number of monasteries, which were daughter houses of it. This centripetal movement continued until the point where, in the 1100s, hundreds of monasteries are all part of this empire of Cluny. Not surprisingly, the initial fervor eventually dies down. It becomes worldly. But for 150 or 200 years, this Benedictine monastery of Cluny is able to preserve the original purpose of monasteries, which was to ensure high spiritual life of those who live in them. Also in the 900s, right at the end of the century, you get the first canonization of a saint by a pope. We saw how previously saint was a fairly loose term used originally for any Christian and then gradually for martyrs and popes and monks who showed extraordinary practice of the virtues. But now it's becoming more systematized. So in 993, the first pope canonizes in an official capacity. Within 100 years or so, 150 years, it's going to be restricted to the papacy, and only popes are allowed to say who's a saint. The numerous wars and political disturbances are very bad for the morals, both of the clergy and of the people. To quote Bielmeyer, the wars and political disturbances fostered robbery, blood revenge, cruelty, gross sensuality, and intemperance. Things were so bad among the laity that, as an innovation, Abbot Odilo of Cluny came up with the idea that he called the peace of God. And this was the idea that you can't slaughter one another from Wednesday night until Monday morning. That period was called the peace of God. This is an attempt to restrain the kind of widespread violence that was going on. Well, it gradually took hold. Eventually, there's a three-year peace of God proclaimed at the time of the First Crusade, 100 years later, around 1100. And then the first three Lateran councils, which are ecumenical councils, prescribe observance of the peace of God for all of Christendom. The ordeal is practiced in the 900s. This was something that had been done by the German tribes before they were ever Christianized, and they brought it into Christianity. It was based on the idea that a Teutonic deity, Odin or Thor or whomever, would reveal the guilt or innocence of someone if that person is tortured. So, forms of torture included fire, water, drowning. hot irons, drawing lots, and duels if you're a free person. In 867, Nicholas I declared the ordeal blasphemous. In 1215, Innocent III outlaws ordeals, and only then does the ordeal start to die out. But you hear about the ordeal later, don't you? You know, in the witchcraft craze, they would throw women into the river bound, and if they drowned, that proves they were innocent. And if they didn't, that proves they were guilty, and then they were killed. Okay, so much for the 900s. Let's move on to the 1000s. It's around 1000 that a corner is turned, and things gradually start to improve. We're moving out of the Dark Ages and into
the Middle Ages.
Around 1000, there's an apocalyptic fever that seizes Christendom. This should not surprise us, because we all remember what happened at 2000. Remember? Y2K scare, and is the world going to end, and so on. Actually, the fear that the world was going to end at exactly midnight of that year 2000 was much stronger back then, because in the book of Revelation, I forget where, chapter 20, verse 2, there's a statement that the devil will rule for 1,000 years. So they figured, you know, if Jesus came in 1 AD, it's now 1,000 years later, the devil's rule is going to end, and therefore the second coming is about to start. The Franks regain control of the Holy Roman Empire from the Germans. The Turks capture Jerusalem in 1076, and that's going to prompt the First Crusade. Before we get to the Crusades, though, let's talk a little bit about church-state relations. During the Dark Ages, when the only forces of law and order were the local lords of manors, so for a couple of valleys, one guy is in charge, things were completely decentralized. And so it was very difficult for the papacy to retain control of appointments of clergy. If I'm a manorial baron off in my fiefdom 200 miles away from Rome, why should I care who the Pope wants to be bishop in my territory? I'm the guy who's locally in charge. I should get to say who's going to be in charge. This became this practice of laity, strongmen, determining who is going to hold ecclesiastical office became known as lay investiture. The investing, referred to in investiture, refers to the mitre and the crozier, you know, that staff with the circle, and the ring. So if I'm the manorial lord and he's my choice, he's a priest in my diocese, then he will come to my castle and I will invest him with these symbols of office, and then he becomes the bishop in my territory. Well, obviously, lay investiture takes away from the papacy the ability to control bishops and to ensure that good and spiritual men are being placed in these offices. So a tug of war arises. Roughly from the 700s, 800s, 900s, there's a tug of war, and during that period, the lay strongmen are winning. They're the ones who are pretty much having the say. In the 1000s, however, the tide turns, and the papacy is able to reassert its centralized jurisdiction over all ecclesiastical offices. This is primarily because of, one pope. His name at birth was Hildebrand. He became a Benedictine monk at the Abbey of Cluny, that reform monastery. So it was really that reform of the monasteries that was able to become a church-wide and even political revolution, reformation of the church. He became a curial official, second-hand man to the Pope, and when the Pope died, he was elected to be Pope, and he became Gregory VII, one of the most important popes ever. One of the things he did was to declare lay investiture to be illegal. From now on, he, the Pope, was to determine all bishops everywhere in the world. Well, obviously, if you've got a couple of hundred years tradition of my dad, my granddad, my great-granddad deciding who our bishop is, then I'm not about to let this Pope 200 miles away tell me that I can't do that. So it all comes to a head, and it comes to a head with a clash between Gregory VII and the Holy Roman Emperor at the time, which is Henry IV. Henry IV refuses to agree to give up his right to appoint bishops in his territory. So the Pope excommunicates him. We talked about the rise of excommunication last time. Henry IV is unimpressed, refuses to have that sway him. So the Pope incurs interdiction on his territory. We saw that last time. Interdiction means religious services cannot go on as usual. No baptisms, no masses, etc. within that territory. And the Pope said to all Europe, you don't have to obey the emperor anymore. Well, all of Europe went with the Pope. And so the Pope really won. As a result, it turned out that the Pope had gone on a trip, and he stopped at a castle in northern Italy in the Alps one winter. And Henry IV, realizing that he was losing his grip, that he was just about to lose all power entirely, decided that this called for drastic action. So he went barefoot to this castle in the snow and the ice, and he stood at the door outside the castle. It's a castle called Canossa in the Alps of Italy. He stood at the door for 3 days, knocking and asking to come in to confess his sins. Finally, the Pope, Gregory VII, allowed him to come in, I'm sure put his feet in bandages, heard his confession, and all seemed to be well, but it was all a ruse. As soon as the Pope lifted the excommunication, lifted the interdiction, Henry IV went right back to his assertion of his right to determine. But this was really the tipping point, the moment at which the papacy had really won. And despite backslidings, from then on, lay investiture ceases to be a major issue. So we see a great centralization or consolidation of power of the papacy under Gregory VII. This is one of the reasons why he's so important. Now, concerning the Crusades, I mentioned that the Turks, who are the Muslims in present-day Turkey, used to be called Asia Minor, that horizontal peninsula right beside and to the east of Greece, had conquered Jerusalem in 1076. A pope in charge, a couple of popes after Gregory VII, this is a fellow named Urban II, is at a council, a regional council, of the bishops in France at Clermont in 1095. And while there, he makes a surprise announcement. He announces to the assembled bishops of France that he's declaring a crusade. He wants to raise an army of Christendom and send them to the Near East to free Jerusalem. Reason being that Jerusalem had been the greatest spot for pilgrimages. We've talked about other spots, St. James Compostela in Spain, Rome itself was a hot spot for pilgrimages, but always Jerusalem had been kind of the ultimate place to go on pilgrimage. Now that the Turks have taken over the Holy Land, Christian pilgrims can no longer go to Jerusalem. So the Pope declares this crusade, first time this had been done, to go and clear a path so that Christian pilgrims can safely return to the holy sites in Jerusalem, especially the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is built where Christ's tomb had been, because the Muslims had vandalized that tomb, that church. It quickly became known as a crusade from the Greek word, from the Latin word crux, which means cross. At the council, crosses were passed out to those who volunteered and acknowledged that they would participate in this crusade. Also, this first crusade in 1095 is very important for the advancement of the idea of indulgences, because the Pope announced, in announcing the crusade, the Pope also said that if you will volunteer to go, you will receive a plenary indulgence. An indulgence means that if you've already been forgiven your sins by going to confession, but you still have punishment due for your sins, you have not done satisfaction for them, then an indulgence will either partly or fully remove that satisfaction still to be made. But anyway, so the Pope declares a plenary indulgence. If you are willing to risk your life, join this army, give up 2 or 3 years of your life going to Jerusalem and back, then this will eliminate all punishment for your sins. It does not forgive your sins. God does that, and he does that in confession. But it removes the punishment that might be due to your sins. Thank you, page 8, she says. Either on this earth or in purgatory. Well, the crusaders form an army. There's a bunch of peasants who get all excited and run off to Jerusalem ahead of time. They are easily squashed by the Turks, put into slavery. But the nobles, the equestrians, the knights on their horses with their armor, form an army, come down, and lo and behold, they retake Jerusalem. They retake the Holy Land. And they form a Latin kingdom of Jerusalem that begins in 1099. The first crusade is successful. There's going to be several more, virtually none of which are going to be successful. So after that first one, it's all downhill, and as we'll see as we come to them in the next 2 or 3 centuries. There's a Eucharistic controversy. We're on page 2 now. In the 1000s, for 1,000 years, Christians have been coming up and receiving the body and blood of Christ without too much thought about exactly what does that mean. Well, a controversy erupts in around the middle of the century, 1047, between two fellows, Lanfranc, who argues that this really is the body of Christ, and this really is the blood of Christ, as opposed to a monk, another monk, Berengarius of Tours, who says, no, it isn't. It's a symbol. When Jesus said, this is my body, that was metaphor. What he really meant was, do this as a memorial of me. So think of me when you do it, but he didn't really mean it. Suffice it to say, about 10 councils condemn this symbolic interpretation. Local councils, not ecumenical councils. A number in Rome and elsewhere, Italy and France. So the upshot of this controversy is that it solidifies what the church had always believed, firmed up what the church had always believed, namely that it truly is Christ's body and blood when the bread and the wine are consecrated. The Eastern Schism. We've been watching during the first 10 centuries of the church how East and West have gradually pulled apart, like cell division. It's now time for that popping of the two so that they become two separate entities. That's what we mean by the Eastern Schism. And the official date for this is 1054, middle of the 1000s. They'd already become, in effect, two churches. The patriarchs of Constantinople don't even bother letting the Pope know when a new one comes into office. In the 1040s, the Pope at that time, Benedict the Ninth, decides that every church on the Italian peninsula has to do masses the way they do in Rome. We talked about various rites. Everybody has to follow the Roman rite in Italy, which meant that the Eastern Orthodox rite, the way it was practiced in Constantinople, was pushed off of the peninsula, pushed east. Well, this won no friends in Constantinople. They became irritated at this. So when a new guy becomes Patriarch of Constantinople, his name is Michael Cerularius, in 1054, the Pope sends a representative, Cardinal Humbert, who's a Spaniard, with a couple other guys, sends them over to Constantinople to talk things over. Now, nobody seems quite clear, but for some reason, when Humbert got to Constantinople, he did not meet with the new Patriarch of Constantinople, Michael Cerularius. Instead, for some reason, he wrote up a writ of excommunication, and he went into the cathedral, Hagia Sophia, and slapped it on the altar and walked out. I don't know what that was, why he did that, but it's very strongly worded. Something got him awfully mad. I've quoted some of it here on the middle of page 2. Humbert puts a bull of excommunication on the altar of Hagia Sophia, which accuses the patriarch of, quote, sowing an abundant crop of heresies. And then it lists a few. Simoniacs, Valesians, Arians, Donatists, Nicolaitans, Cerverians, Pneumatikoi, Nazarenes. You sort of feel like they threw in everything they could think of to accuse as a heresy that the East is engaged in. And then the bull adds, let Michael, the current Patriarch of Constantinople, and all those who follow him in the above-mentioned errors come under the anathema. Anathema means curse. Let everyone who persists in attacking the faith of the Holy Roman Church and its sacrifice be anathema. Maranatha, that means Lord come. And not be considered as a Catholic Christian, but as a prosamite heretic. Needless to say, Michael did not accept. Prosamite, by the way, comes from the root Zyma, Z-Y-M-A. Zyma in Greek means yeast. It had developed that the Eastern Church continued to use leavened bread, which was apparently what was used in the earliest church, whereas in the West it became common to use unleavened bread, which is what we do now. So to call the Patriarch of Constantinople a prosamite means you pro-yeast person. Anyway, so Michael, the Patriarch of Constantinople, turns around and does the same favor back and excommunicates the West. He writes an encyclical which maintains the East's orthodoxy and condemns the West's heresy. He says reconciliation with Rome is not even desirable. To make matters worse, in 1204, a bunch of crusaders, happens to be the Fourth Crusade, stop by Constantinople on their way to the Middle East and sack it, rape and pillage throughout the city, and set up their own kingdom. There's a Latin kingdom in Constantinople, I think from 1204 to 1266, which the East is still very angry about. Yes, sir.
Dr. Hine, I'm looking at this excommunication from the cardinal, and this is the first, right here about 1054, this is the first that I'm seeing the word Catholic Christian come into play. Is this about the time that the terminology of Catholicism is coming into the Christian religion?
Yeah. Certainly, from this point onward, Orthodox gets adopted by the East as a term by which they wish to be known, and Catholic becomes adopted by the West as a term by which they wish to be known. But the entire church prior to this was both Catholic and Orthodox. Catholicos in Greek means universal, and so the one universal church was Catholicos. But the one universal church was also Orthodox. Doxa means opinion or belief, and orthos means straight, so right believing. So I don't know why, but the one characteristic of the universal church becomes the term by which the Western church is known, and the other becomes the term by which the Eastern church is known. But both terms had been used for the entire church prior to this. They're not new terms.
Wasn't it in the 200s that, I can't remember, it wasn't the first time Christian was used, it was the first time Catholic. Wasn't it one of your handouts? Anyway, we don't want to get...
Saying something about the Catholic Church? Am I wrong about that?
No. Ignatius of Antioch wrote seven letters to churches around 110 A.D., just before he gets martyred. But I don't remember anything...
I think he says in one of those letters that wherever you find our Lord Jesus Christ, you will find the Catholic Church.
Or vice versa. Wherever you find the Roman Church, there you find the Church of Christ. He was very pro-Roman. Maybe that's what you're thinking. The other thing he's noted for is the monarchical episcopate, the idea that a bishop is like a monarch in his diocese. So maybe one of those. At any rate, so what happens now that the two have split? Well, they basically stay split until 40 years ago or so, right after Vatican Council II, at the end of Vatican Council II, in 1965, this is the bottom of page 2, Pope Paul VI and Patriarch Athenagoras I, Paul VI was in Rome at the Vatican, and Athenagoras I was at Constantinople, in a joint declaration, they efface from the memory and presence of the Church the sentences of excommunication, and they say that the Eastern Schism should be blotted out. Well, does that mean that the schism no longer exists? No, it still exists. We're still split. But at least we've now admitted that we shouldn't be. That's a step in the right direction. And maybe in the next 100 years or so, we'll resolve it permanently. We mentioned how Gregory VII was able to assert papal power over even the Holy Roman Emperor in that lay investiture controversy. Other ways in which he asserted his supremacy are listed for us at the top of page 4, if you want to head there. In 1075, he put out a document called the Dictatus Papae, nothing to do with spinach, in which he says, only the Pope can depose, reinstate, or transfer bishops. Now there's the lay investiture controversy put to rest. Only the Pope can make new laws for the entire church. Only the Pope can convoke general councils, ecumenical or worldwide council. Only the Pope can make final decisions in controversies, whether those be about doctrines or jurisdictional or whatever. Only the Pope is sanctioned by the merits of St. Peter, and only the Pope can wear special insignia, like the tiara affixed to the special mitre he wears. This convoking of general councils, prior to 1000, general councils had been convoked by emperors. Constantine convoked the first one, which was the Council of Nicaea in 325, and then other emperors after him had convoked all the other ones. At this point, however, Hildebrand, or Gregory VII, is saying that's not going to happen anymore. The Pope is the one who convokes the ecumenical council. Now, during that first 1,000 years, a council was only recognized as ecumenical if, at its conclusion, the Pope approved what it had decided. So it's not like the emperors were making up church doctrine or something. But from this point on, there has never been an instance where an emperor has called a church council. All the ones throughout the Middle Ages and the modern period have been convoked by popes. Papal infallibility gets advanced. The understanding of papal infallibility is advanced by Gregory VII. Around 180 AD, Irenaeus of Lyon, early church father, said that only the Roman church possesses the decisive teaching authority for the entire church. So this idea has been around for centuries. In 519, the formula Hormisdai, Pope Hormisdas, says that in matters of faith, the Roman church has never erred, made a mistake. In 680, Pope Agatho says the Roman church will never err, can never err. Why? Because the gates of hell will not prevail against it, and because, as Jesus says 4 times in John 13-17, I will send the Holy Spirit and he will guide you into all truth. In 1075, which is Gregory the Seventh's document, Dictatus Papae, to support papal infallibility, Gregory the Seventh cites Luke 22. I have prayed for you that your own faith may not fail, Jesus says to Peter, and when once you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. A couple of centuries later, theologians like Aquinas are arguing for papal infallibility in a full-blown, explicit way. Ultimately, it's going to be declared by an ecumenical council, namely Vatican I, in 1869-70.
Mm-hmm. Infallibility, isn't that a special preface statement that the Pope says before he makes his declaration of what's infallible, the whatever he's declaring at the moment? Isn't there, I think there's a special statement he says first to say this is truly infallible and then proceeds and declares it. Whereas if he does regular talks, right, it's not under the cloak of infallibility.
Actually, if you look at that document that Vatican I put out on papal infallibility in 1869 or 1870, what it says is not that the Pope has to make exactly this statement first, set of words, but it does say that in order for a papal declaration to be infallible, the Pope has to say that he intends this to be believed by all Catholics everywhere. And it also has to be a declaration having to do with faith or morals. He can't say it's going to rain on Friday and infallibly be correct, not faith or morals. I was at a cocktail party several years ago at this party, Bishop Fiorenza was there, the previous bishop. And we were, a couple of the guys, the four of us were standing in a circle, and we were all, you know, holding little drinks and chatting. And Bishop Fiorenza made the statement, there has never been an infallible declaration having to do with morals. And by that he meant not just papal, but conciliar. No council has ever made an infallible declaration about morals. It's always been about faith. And that interested me, and I started looking it up, and I found two books that said the same thing. So I don't know if you trust Fiorenza or not, but that's what he said. And there is some confirmation for it. So that's my understanding, that that's the case. Actually, papal infallibility has been very rarely used twice, right, in church history? There's been infallible papal declarations. What were they? Time for a quiz. Immaculate Conception. When was that declared? 1854 by Pius IX. So that's one. The Pope said, I intend this to be believed by all Christians from now forever, and as universal head of the church, I declare this to be the case. The other one was the Assumption of Mary. Unfortunately, the document that was pronounced by Pius XII in 1950, unfortunately, the document doesn't say what she assumed. It doesn't say what she assumed. It's a joke. Okay. Right. Assumption means she passed from this world to the next bodily and painlessly. So those are the only two instances of use of papal infallibility thus far in church history. Cardinals become important with the Gregorian reform, the reform of the church by Gregory the Seventh. They tended to be around 20 or 30 of them at any given time. They elect the new pope. They're in charge of the church during the period that the chair is empty. There is no pope. They are the pope's immediate assistants. I'm at the top of page 5. They participate in important decisions in consistories. A consistory is a committee with the pope as its theoretical chairman, but a lot of the consistories are pretty much autonomous nowadays. They served as papal legates, representatives of the pope in foreign capitals. When did they start wearing red? Well, it turns out 1245. Fourth of the way down, page 5. Innocent IV grants cardinals the red hat as a symbol of their dignity. 50 years later, they're starting to wear scarlet mantles. 1464, they get the scarlet beretta. Is that why we call that bird a cardinal, do you suppose? Don't they have scarlet epaulettes on their wings, I think? The curia, as you might imagine, becomes important. I haven't looked it up, although I am curious. But I would suspect that just like there's a piece of furniture called a curio something, curio cabinet. And doesn't that have a bunch of slots in it? So I'm assuming that this word curia or curio in Latin means a bunch of slots. And that's the various administrative divisions of the Vatican. In 1000s, the Pope's many officials and assistants are for the first time called the Curia Romana. Papal finances. Well, the papacy is not just the way it is nowadays. What is it? 1 or 2 square miles called Vatican City? It's the entire midsection of the Italian peninsula. It rules the papal states. It's one of the European countries at the time, like France or like Germany or like various dukes. The Duke of Savoy has the top third of Italy and so on. So if you're going to run a country, you need a lot of money. Where did the popes get their money? Well, here's the various sources of revenue. They got revenues from the papal states and other properties, monasteries and churches with exemptions. Those who were directly under the jurisdiction of the Pope had to pay taxes. There was such a thing as Peter's pence. You've heard of that, right? We still do that. Pence means penny, so little amounts offered by individuals voluntarily in England, Poland, Hungary, and Scandinavian countries. Most important was when a new bishop or abbot took office, he would send 1/3 of his first year's income to the papacy. Unfortunately, last item on page 5, in 1289, Nicholas IV put the cardinals in charge of the finances. And that was a bad move because they started appointing the tax collectors. And so there's a conflict of interest. And obviously corruption is going to occur. Middle of page 6, architecture. A new style of architecture comes into existence. It's really from the 800s. To the 1100s or so. It's called Romanesque, characterized by massive walls, rounded arches, not pointed, and relatively simple ornamentation, not a lot of gaudy gargoyles and all that kind of stuff. That's later. There are choir lofts, towers, columns, arched windows and doors, religious orders that get going in the 1000s. I'm on fourth the way down, page 7. Include the hermit orders, the Camaldolese, come into existence. Around 1000, Romuald reforms about 100 unconnected monasteries and, in imitation of Cluny, associates them all together in a big federation of monasteries. But these are hermits. Each monk lives in his own little cabin on the property and hoes his own little garden out front to eat vegetables. And they don't get together as a group except on Sundays when they have a worship service. Each of them is basically living a solitary life. Peter Damian, one of the important reformers who supported Gregory VII, is a member of one of these hermit orders. Also in the 1000s, the Augustinians become solidified, organized. They were strongly encouraged by Gregory VII. Remember, the Augustinians are basically the diocesan priests who, at the cathedral, all live as if they were a monastery. Even though they're actively engaged with the laity, doing masses and confessions and baptisms and so on, as a group, they try to live a kind of monastic life. And almost always, these canons regular, as they were called, adopted the Augustinian rule, which was the collection of bits of advice that had been culled from Augustine's writings back in the 400s. Other groups that get going in the 1000s, near the end of the century, are the Carthusians, and which is a hermit order, and the Cistercians, which are a reform of the Cluny order. I mentioned how Cluny had become worldly. Well, here you have a minority among them saying, wait a minute, this is not what was intended, so they break off and make their own group. The most famous Cistercian probably is Thomas Merton. You've heard of him? Let's go to page 8. Now, up until the 1000s, there is no adoration of the Eucharist. Only a few particles of the bread that was consecrated on Sunday mornings would be kept in order to be taken to the sick or the elderly as viaticum later in the week. But starting in the 1000s, there starts to be reservation of the sacrament. The actual term transubstantiation comes into use. It's first used in 1079, and 150 years later, it's approved by an ecumenical council, Lateran Council IV. Did we talk about transubstantiation previously? I meant earlier than tonight. Well, let me just briefly review it. You all know it anyway, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. According to Aristotle, everything that exists has an essence. So this chair has the essence of chair. This lectern has the essence of lectern. This horse has the essence of horse. This dog has the essence of dog. You can also call it a nature, horse nature, dog nature, human nature. Or you can call it a substance. And substance comes from stand, S-T-A, and sub. So that which stands under or is the substance of a chair is chairness or chair nature. That which stands under a horse is horse substance or horse nature. Under a dog, dog substance or dog nature. Now the idea with transubstantiation, the prefix trans means across, is that at the moment of consecration, the substance or bread nature removes, goes away, and a new substance, a new essence, takes its place, which is Jesus himself. So the appearance of bread, the surface characteristics, what Aristotle called accidents, whiteness, brown top, the smell, all of these characteristics are still there, but that which stands under them and supports them is Jesus' nature. We say body and blood, but we mean that all of Jesus is present in the bread and all of Jesus is present in the wine. There have been other theories concerning the Eucharist. We already mentioned one tonight. That's a symbolic one. At the moment of consecration, bread nature stays there and Christ nature doesn't show up. It just stays bread. And it's solely a memorial service, nothing more. Exactly. A third theory, in addition to transubstantiation and the symbolic theory, is consubstantiation. Now, you still got substantiation, which means you're talking about substances, the essence of this. But con means with. So, according to consubstantiation, at the moment of consecration, bread nature stays under the appearances, the characteristics of bread, and Christ nature joins it. So it is simultaneously ordinary bread and Christ's body. I had the privilege 4 days ago of having lunch with a Lutheran theologian who normally lives up north, but he was down here giving a conference. And I knew that he had written his dissertation on the Lutheran concept of the Eucharist, which I've always been curious about. So I wrote him and I said, can we have lunch? I want to quiz you about this. So he said, okay. So I took him to lunch and I said, do Lutherans believe in consubstantiation? And he said, no. And I said, okay, then what do you believe? And I swear, we had lunch for an hour and talked about it, and I'm still not clear exactly what they believe. One thing he said was, Lutherans believe that the Eucharist is, they believe in a real presence. Jesus really is present. So they don't believe in symbolic interpretation. Calvinists believe in that, but not Lutheran. But he also said that they believe in real presence only as it's being used. I said, what do you mean by used? He said, as it's being eaten and drunk. So as it's being eaten and drunk, Christ is really present there. I said, well, is it still bread and wine? He said, we don't ask that. So I still don't know exactly. This guy did a doctoral dissertation on it. He's a Lutheran theologian. So I think they prefer not to ask those questions, which they have every right not to ask if they choose, you know. One could say you're treading on sacred things when you ask these things or whatever. But anyway, transubstantiation is the idea that this is no longer bread, but it is really and truly Jesus, just as much as grabbing Jesus' hand back in 30 AD would have been Jesus. So I'm glad that that's what we Catholics believe. Here's indulgences, as you said, page 8, but we've already talked about that. Let's move on to the 1100s. The Second Crusade, top of page 10, is preached by Bernard of Clairvaux after the Turks take Edessa, a city in present-day Syria. So an army is raised, they go down there, they attack Damascus, present capital of Syria, but they fail to capture it. Like I said, most of the Crusades after the first are failures. There's a third Crusade at the end of the 1100s, 1189 to 91. Jerusalem falls to Saladin. Saladin was actually a Kurd. You know the Kurds in northern Iraq now? Although he was in charge of Egypt. His army was able to retake Jerusalem. That ended that Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. But Richard I of England went down and negotiated with him and was able to form a truce, which allowed a corridor of safe passage for Christian pilgrims to still visit the Holy Sepulchre. Concerning heresies, we've seen that the Orthodox and the Catholics have split. Various groups from Orthodoxy start to recombine with the Catholic Church. There's a group in southern Italy and Sicily that rejoins in the 1000s. I put this in the 1100s because the most important group, the Maronites, reunite in the 1100s. These are Lebanese Christians. They practice the Syro-Antiochene rite. Today, they are the largest group of Eastern Catholics. Eastern Catholics simply means Eastern Orthodox groups, which at some point after 1054, when they split, have rejoined communion with the Roman Church. Anything you'd like to add? You're Lebanese, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Did you used to be Maronite? Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right, yeah. In the 1100s to 1700s, groups of Arminians at two or three occasions rejoined the Catholic Church. We're going to see a major rejoining of Ukrainians, but that's a couple centuries from now, so we'll talk about that when it happens. Yeah. In the 800s, missionaries from Constantinople named Cyril and Methodius, a couple of monks, went up into the Slavic groups like the Bulgarians and so on, Hungarians, and converted them, and so they practiced Orthodox Christianity, even though they hadn't split yet and weren't called that. That went on up. The group that I'm going to refer to later is the Ukrainians. They were Orthodox, and the Belarusians were Orthodox, Belarus. But the king of Poland wound up in charge. Poland was much bigger than it is now. It included Ukraine, it included Lithuania, it included Latvia. And so the king of Poland, who was Catholic, gave an ultimatum to the Orthodox bishops in those territories of his kingdom and said, you must become Catholic. And all but a couple of them did. I wish I could remember. We're going to come across it next week, I suspect. So, yeah. Okay. Waldensians. Here's a heresy that arose in the 1100s, started by a fellow named Peter Waldo, or Valdez, it's sometimes said to be. He was a middle-class or lower upper-class fellow, a merchant, who, at the death of a friend, became hyper-religious, gave away all his possessions to his wife so that he lived on nothing, stuck his two daughters in convents, and he started up a group that preached absolute poverty, owning nothing. Who does that sound like? St. Francis, exactly. And in fact, St. Francis and the Franciscans are going to be approved about 100 years after this, less than 100 years after this, in 1207 or so. But there's a major difference, and that is the Franciscans stayed orthodox, whereas the Waldensians got further and further radical in their criticisms of the church. If you take a look at these statements at the bottom of page 10, they wound up saying things like this. The church is no longer the Church of Christ, but went astray when the Pope accepted material goods from Constantine. Only the Waldensians are true to Christ. Pope, clergy, and monks are Pharisees. Well, that won them a lot of friends. One should not support the church materially. Let the clergy work with their hands like everyone else. Eventually, the Waldensians reject the sacrament of holy orders. Any layman or laywoman can be Christ's minister. Some eventually deny all sacraments except baptism and the Eucharist. Some reject any real presence except at the moment of communion. Well, all of this sounds a lot like Protestantism, which is going to show up later. And in fact, the Waldensians get excommunicated by the Pope in 1184. But they immediately say, well, excommunication doesn't apply if you're a good person. So it rolled off their backs like water. From 1250, for about 150 years, the Inquisition persecutes the Waldensians. And in the 1400s, they decline. But after Protestantism starts, some of them join Protestant groups and meld into them. There are some very small groups of Waldensians who still exist. A church of the Waldensians in Rome today has the inscription Lux in Tenebris, which means light in darkness. You can guess what they consider the darkness. Another heresy that gets going in the 1100s is called Catharism. Or because it was big in southern France, an area referred to at the time as Albigensia, they were also called Albigensians. These are really a recrudescence of Gnostics. We talked about Gnostics, was it the first night maybe? I'm not sure. But basically, the Cathars had two groups. There was a group called the Perfecti, who were the leaders, and there was a group of ordinary Cathars who were second class and would not be saved. The Cathars, like the Gnostics, were anti-matter. They thought matter was evil. Well, if you think matter is evil, then you want to touch it as little as possible. So the Perfecti were vegetarians. They wore black. They were itinerant. They had no permanent homes. They wandered around from one flock of Cathari to another. And they were celibate. Obviously, if you think matter is bad, you don't want to reproduce human bodies because those are material. The Cathari also... The Cathari and the Waldensians are the reason why the Inquisition began. The Inquisition really began in the 1230s. I don't think I have most of my material on the Inquisition in this handout. We'll look at it next week as it gets bigger in the 1300s. Page 13. What's going on with theology in the 1100s? Well, a major theologian in the 1100s, a fellow named Peter Lombard, obviously an Italian who lives in Lombardy and a descendant of the German Lombards. He is the main teacher at the Cathedral School in Paris, which is very soon going to become the University of Paris. And while there, he writes a four-volume summary of theology. He does this by looking at all of the preceding writings of the Church Fathers, of earlier theologians, papal documents, conciliar pronouncements. He organizes it all, puts it together in a very straightforward, unbiased, non-argumentative fashion. This becomes extremely popular, this four-volume set, and it becomes the standard textbook of theology for the next 400-500 years. Throughout the Middle Ages, Lombard's Book of Sentences, it's called. Sententia means proposition, so set of statements that the church has made on various topics becomes the textbook for theology. Aquinas, for example, 100 years after Lombard, writes a commentary. He's not the only one. Everybody who graduates in theology throughout the Middle Ages pretty much writes a commentary on Peter Lombard's sentences, four books of sentences. Even Luther, in the early 1500s, writes a commentary on Lombard's four books of sentences. So Peter Lombard is an important theologian. I mentioned that this school at the cathedral in Paris, Notre Dame, had become an important center for theological thinking. It, in the second half of the 1100s, somewhere between 1150 and 1175, it morphs into the University of Paris because the students form a union. They organize in order to protect their rights. So the earliest university comes into existence at this point. There are none prior to this in Christendom. This idea of a university, a place where the entire universe of thought is promoted, research into all areas of thinking occurs, takes on. And so shortly afterward, in 1195, the second university shows up. That's in Bologna in Italy. It specializes in law, just as the University of Paris specialized in theology and philosophy. And from then on, they start sprouting everywhere. Mostly in the 1200s, 1300s, they're occurring in Spain, France, and Italy. The first university in Northern Europe, which is the University of Prague, appears in 1347. By 1400, there are 44 universities in Europe. By 1500, there's 79. So, and then, of course, when the New World is discovered, they start founding them here, and that's why we have University of St. Thomas. The word sacrament. This is kind of interesting. Up to this point, up to the 1100s, sacrament meant any holy object or any doctrine or any ritual action could be called a sacramentum. In the 1100s, however, as theology as a science gets going, thanks to Peter Lombard and the rise of the universities, it comes to be used for those seven special actions of the church. Lombard in the sentences, for example, restricted the word to the seven sacraments. And so from this point on, it means a visible sign instituted by Christ to signify and to give inward grace. There are, page 14, there are signs of increased reverence for the Eucharist that are recurring here. Most important of which is restriction of the distribution of the Eucharist to the bread alone. The cup is reserved for the priesthood from this point on. That occurred because the Eucharist is being seen more and more reverently. So it wasn't any kind of attempt to downplay the importance of the laity or make them second-class citizens or something. But we'll see next time that this leads to a major controversy in the church with the Hussites. Elevation and consecration had never been done in the first 11 centuries. Now in the 1100s, to indicate better the moment of consecration, a church council at Paris orders that the clergy elevate the host for adoration after the words of institution. In the 1000s, people start kneeling when a priest passes them as he's taking viaticum to the sick or elderly. And so in 1271 to 76, Gregory X orders that the faithful kneel at Mass from consecration to communion. That's where that got started. Stained glass, bottom of page 14. The earliest known instances are from the 800s. In the 1200s, it reaches its height. And this is when Notre Dame gets that beautiful rose glass that you've all seen. Mystery plays arise. Mystery here doesn't mean whodunit. It just means having to do with a religious mystery, like Christ's death or resurrection or whatever. Mystery plays, I'm on page 15. Mystery plays grow out of the liturgy on major feasts. They are very popular and help to instruct and edify. At first, they only occur on Easter, the Passion, and Christmas plays. Later, there are plays for other feast days concerning Christ, like Christ the King, various lives of saints, eschatological events, like the judgment, various parables are enacted. There also arise burlesques, where the clergy make fun of themselves. On one day of the year, it's called the Feast of Fools, and later there's another one called the Feast of Asses on Palm Sunday, where they poke fun at themselves. I think that's kind of healthy. And we're done.
Okay. Have some snacks and see you next week.
Okay. Thank you.